So, today we're going to be talking about textual analysis. And a lot of what I'm going to be talking about in textual analysis, you've actually already had some of it, so I'm not going to go over it again. I'm just going to cover the new stuff. But before we get to textual analysis, I just want to have a short review of genre analysis. Everybody ready? Yeah? So, I think the most important thing about genre analysis that I can emphasize to you is that genres are related to groups of people. Yeah? Genres are related to discourse communities. Yeah? And part of being a member of a discourse community is being able to competently produce certain kinds of genres. And this was a point that was actually made again in this week's reading when the author of this week's reading was talking about real Indians. Did anyone read this week's reading yet? Yeah? Well, in this week's reading, he talks about real Indians. Now, when he's referring to real Indians, do you want me to give my lecture, or you want to give a lecture? You can say into the paper for it. Everyone can hear on the podcast. Okay, good. So when he was talking about real Indians, he wasn't referring to Indian Indians like from India, right? He was actually referring to American Indians, Native Americans. And what he was saying is that people in this particular ethnic group in America, have a distinction between people who are real Indians and people who are not real Indians, right? Because the fact is, in America, so many Indians have married with white people and other kinds of settlers that you may only have some Indian heritage in your blood, and you may also have some other ethnic heritage as well. So how do they tell whether somebody is a real Indian or not a real Indian? And it turns out it has a lot to do not with who your mother is or who your father is. It has a lot to do with the genres that you have mastered. And one of the genres that real Indians master is this genre called razzing. Razzing is a special kind of ritual insulting . In fact, ritual insulting is actually quite important for many groups of people. For example, male secondary school students in Hong Kong also engage in a kind of ritual insulting, right? Where they use foul language to each other, where they talk to each other about each other's mothers in very impolite ways. Yes? I'm sure most of you have heard this kind of genre. This is a genre. And in order to be accepted in these groups of boy students, you need to learn how to do this ritual insulting, right? Black people, African Americans in certain urban centers in America also are involved in a certain kind of ritual insulting. But it's actually a slightly different kind of genre where they use kind of rap music and rhythm and rhyme and this sort of thing in order to insult each other. And Indians also have a kind of ritual insulting called razzing. And the point is that if you don't know how to do this, then people in this particular group won't consider you a real Indian, even if you look like an Indian, even if you have red skin and black hair and you wear feathers and you have all the other characteristics that you might associate with Native Americans. They wouldn't accept you as a member of this group because you haven't mastered this sort of genre. And so this kind of illustrates how important genres are. Genres are not just a matter of being able to produce text in the right way or in a certain way. Genres are really a matter of membership in particular communities. So in the same way, for you guys, in order to be students in a university, you have to master certain kinds of genres. The most important genre being the examination. You need to know how to take examinations. If you don't know how to take examinations, you can't get into university, can you? Right? So that's a very, very important genre. Later, when you leave City University and you try to get a job, your attempt to get this job will be based on your ability to produce certain kinds of genres. And one of the most important genres that you will have to produce in order to get this job is called the application letter. And so last week we talked a little bit about move analysis, and I know you've done quite a lot of move analysis with Steve Bremner. And so I just want to go through this rather quickly and look at the different moves in this letter so that we can understand what the genre of an application letter is made of. What moves, what communicative moves go in to making the communicative purpose. And so communicative purpose is purpose is the heart of a genre, right? We should be able to identify, well, what is the communicative purpose of a genre? What is the communicative purpose of a job application letter, Kenji? What's the purpose? To get a job, right? It's very easy, right? So the communicative purpose is to get a job. And then in order to reach this purpose, we have a number of moves, communicative moves that are put into this letter in a certain kind of structure or in a certain kind of order. Now, the problem that a lot of people have with genre analysis is they think that it's really complicated, but it's actually very, very simple. Right? And so when I ask you these questions about what move is being realized or what move is being accomplished in certain kinds of sections, try not to think too much. Right? If you think too much, then it's difficult to come up with the answer. But if you don't think too much, if you just say the first thing that comes to your mind, it's actually very easy. For example, here in the beginning of this letter, we have Mr. George Gilhooey, XYZ Company, 87 Delaware Road, Hatfield, Connecticut, 08065-909-555-5555. What is the purpose? What is the move that's being accomplished, Matco, in this section of the letter? What are they doing? Okay, so telling who the letter is for, right? Telling who the letter is for. And so all business letters are like this. The first move is always to tell who the letter is for. Not only to tell who the letter is for, but also to tell something about this person, like where they live and what their telephone number is, what their contact information is, right? So it's a kind of a format in all business letters that we actually always have to begin with the move of telling who this letter is for. And then we have September 22nd, 2007. Edward, what move is being accomplished in that line? It's the date. So what is it, what are they doing when they write that line? They are, what is that date? What happened on that date? That's right. That's right. They wrote the letter. That was the date they wrote the letter. So we can say the move here is telling when the letter was written. Telling when the letter was written. Okay. Very easy, you see? So that's the thing about genre analysis and move analysis. Actually, it's usually quite obvious what they're doing. People get into trouble in genre analysis because they think, oh, it must be something quite fancy or more difficult than that. They think it's too simple. But actually, move analysis is really simple. Dear Mr. Gilhooley, Margaret. Salutation. Very good. Salutation. Salutation is a kind of fancy word, saying hello. Right? So what they are actually doing is greeting, saying hello, right, to the person that they're writing the letter to. Then we get to the first paragraph here. I am writing to apply for the programmer position advertised in the Times Union. As requested, I'm enclosing a complete job application, my certification, my resume, and 3 references. So in this paragraph, we actually have 2 moves. Yeah? What is the first move, Heidi? Good. Telling the purpose of the letter. Right? Telling the purpose of the letter. But within telling the purpose of the letter, there are also some sub-moves that are actually very, very important for this kind of letter. Right? So he says, programmer position and Times Union. So programmer position is the job he's applying for, and time fusion is where he saw the advertisement. Yeah, and that's actually very important information. So we can say maybe sub-moves are specifying position applied for, specifying where they saw the advertisement. Right? And then the second sentence here, as requested, I'm enclosing a completed job application, my certification, and my resume, and three references. Candy, what are they doing? Right, enclosure of documents, right? Telling what documents are attached or telling what documents are enclosed. So you see, it's actually quite simple. The opportunity presented in this listing is very interesting, and I believe that my strong technical experience and education will make me a very competitive candidate for this position. The key strengths that I possess for success in this position include I have successfully blah blah, I strive blah blah, I provide blah blah, with a BS degree blah blah blah. I also have experience in learning and excelling in new technologies as needed. So this is actually quite a long paragraph, but it's really only one move. It's really only one move. What's the move? Lillian, what's the move? Yeah, telling him. So really just telling about himself, telling his qualifications for the job. Right? Telling why he's suitable for the job. All of these things are basically what's happening. So it's actually very long. We can say that this is the most important move, right, in this. And this one we can also break it down into several small moves, right? Because he's actually doing a lot of small things in this, right? For example, he is showing enthusiasm for the job, right? He is telling what kind of degree he has. So telling his qualifications, right? He is talking about his experience, and he's talking about his abilities, right? Experience, abilities, qualifications, and enthusiasm. He's expressing all four of those things in the big move of telling about himself. Please see my resume for additional information on my experience. What is he doing? Melody. Okay. So here he says, please see my resume for additional information on my experience. So he's basically telling them to see his resume, right? That's it. It's very simple. Yeah. So we can call it referring to attachment or referring to enclosure or referring to his resume. Right? It's very interesting that this resume business comes at the beginning of the letter when he's talking about the enclosures, and also comes at the end of the letter. And this tells you something about this kind of genre, that this kind of genre is always accompanied by another genre, always accompanied by a resume. And really, when you apply for a job, really the main thing is your resume, right? It's not this letter, right? The really key thing is your resume. If you just send this letter and you don't send a resume, you're not going to get the job. And so really, we can say that one of the main communicative purposes here, of course the communicative purpose is to get a job, but one of the main purposes is to introduce the resume. Right? The whole point of this letter is to introduce the resume. I can be reached anytime via my cell phone, blah, 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 blah. Thank you for your time and consideration. I look forward to speaking with you about this employment opportunity. So this is three moves. One move per sentence. Who can tell me what the first move is? Andy. I can be reached anytime via my cell phone. Yeah, easy. Yeah, give contact information. Yeah, giving his contact information. Yeah? Thank you for your time and consideration. What are they doing? This is a really hard one. Venus, what are they doing? Thanking. Very easy, you see? Just thanking, right? Thanking. And then Actually, the hardest one is the last one. I look forward to speaking with you about this employment opportunity. What are they doing there? What are they really doing there? Heidi, what are they really doing there? Asking for a response. Kind of requesting an interview, right? But they're doing it in a very subtle way, right? They're not saying, please give me the interview. They just say, oh, I look forward to talking to you, right? Which means, please let me talk to you, right? I really want to talk to you. I really want to have an interview for this job, right? And we'll talk a little more next week about this kind of sentence, right? This kind of indirect speech act and why the writer has decided to use this speech act. Right? So you can see, first of all, you can see that move analysis is very easy. Second, you can see that this kind of letter always follows a predictable set of moves. If you want to get a job, then you should probably follow these moves pretty closely. Why is it so important to follow these moves so closely? Is there any other kind of letter that this reminds you of? Maybe a kind of letter that you actually looked at in Steve's class. Promotional letter. It's a sales letter. Actually, we can say that the job application letter is a subgenre of a sales letter. You're selling yourself. You're the product. Right? And so one of the main reasons why it's so important to be able to write this letter, one of the main reasons why when you apply for a job, the employer looks at this kind of letter is to see if you can write this kind of letter. Yeah? Because this is the kind of letter that you're going to have to write in your job, in most jobs, right? This kind of business letter, right? If you're applying for a job as a cook in a restaurant, probably not so important. You might not even include an application letter for that kind of job, right? But if you're applying for any kind of business post, right, one of the main reasons that they want this kind of letter is that they want to see if you can write a letter. Yeah? If you can write a letter, even if you have a perfect resume, you graduated from Hong Kong U, you know, and you've got all A's in all your subjects, but you write this letter and it's all ridiculous and wrong, they're not going to hire you because they say, oh, okay, you have a good resume, but you can't write a business letter. And so, in a way, this is like a test. Yeah, it's like a rehearsal for what you're going to have to do. It's a test to see if you have mastered the kind of genre that you need to master to become a member of this discourse community, basically. Are there any questions about this? It's really not so difficult. Okay. So now we're going to go on to talking about text analysis. We're really going to be talking about grammar today. I know that you all love grammar so much. It's one of your favorite subjects, and indeed, it's one of my favorite subjects. So I share this with you. We share an abiding love and interest in grammar. The reason I love grammar so much, Heidi, is because grammar equals reality. Yeah, grammar equals reality. That is, the grammar that we use in our language is what we use to build our reality. And people with different ideas of grammar, people who speak different languages, actually have different ideas about reality. Right? Grammar and lexical vocabulary is what really determines how you see the world. It's the way you build reality. Grammar is the way we express meanings, right? Grammar is the way we express what we are doing when we're writing or talking. Grammar is the way we express our identity, yeah? Different people use different kinds of grammar, right? Different situations call for different kinds of grammar. Grammar is the way that we express the connections between the different kinds of texts that we're using and also the connections between the sentences in the same text. And also, grammar tells you something about what kinds of modes we're using when we're speaking. So we have grammar of written language, but when we speak, we have a grammar of spoken language. It's totally different, isn't it? Right? And the grammar of spoken language is not the same as the grammar of written language. And we have a grammar of a kind of body language, don't we? And that's actually different from written language or spoken language as well. So grammar can also tell you something about the modes that you are using. In the reading for this week, the author of the reading lists a whole bunch of questions, and these questions are to guide you when you're doing a textual analysis. And so you should use these questions when you're doing your own textual analysis. Right? And we're going to go through some of these questions today, but we're not going to go through all of them, because some of these issues we've already talked about in a previous course, the course Languages, Cultures, and Communication. You all remember that course? Vaguely, sometime in the past, you took this course. And so I suggest that you go back to your notes from this course, or go back to the website from this course, and look at some of the readings that have to do with grammar. I think it's week 3 reading. I put a link in this PowerPoint for the reading that you can go to look at it. And most of the stuff on this first slide we actually talked about in that class. That is, we talked about how when you look at a sentence, you need to pay attention to two things. You need to pay attention to the process, what is being done. For example, is it a mental process? Is it a material process? Right? Is it a relational process? And also the participants, yeah? Who is doing what to whom, right? So the questions are, what kinds of verbs are being used? What participants are included and excluded? How are the participants named? How would other ways of formulating the clauses lead to the inclusion or exclusion of different participants? What subjects and objects have been chosen? How does the choice shape our negotiation with the text? How could the clauses have been said or written differently, and with what consequences in terms of negotiations over what claims are being made and how and why they are valid? So pretty much all of this we covered in Languages, Cultures, and Communication. I'm going to refer a little bit to it today, but I'm not going to go too deeply into this. What I'm going to be going deeply into today are the questions in blue, because these are things that we haven't talked about before. And these are questions about how texts are organized. Yeah? In particular, how questions about how we emphasize certain kinds of information in a text and de-emphasize other kinds of information. So questions of how the speaker or hearer has chosen themes and reams for each of her clauses, how whole clause themes for sentences with more than one clause have been chosen, how could the sentences have been said or written differently, with what communicative consequences, how has the speaker or writer connected his clauses together to signal their logical relationships, what information is being foregrounded and asserted, what information is being backgrounded and assumed, how could things have been said or written differently, and with what communicative consequences. So these are the issues that we're going to be focusing on today. You'll notice that there's one question here that keeps being repeated. How could it have been done differently? And this is really the main question you've always got to ask yourself whenever you're analyzing a text. Right? You say, okay, they chose to do it this way, but they could have done it that way. Why didn't they do it that way? Why did they do it this way? If they had done it that way, how would the text be different? That's a kind of key question it's always good to ask when you're analyzing text. Now, these last three questions are also things that we talked about last year in Languages, Cultures, and Communication. That is questions of cohesion. Right? So I'm sure all you remember cohesive devices like reference and logical connectors and lexical cohesion, anaphoric, cataphoric, all those sorts of things that we discussed last year. Okay? We'll review that a little bit at the end of the lecture, at the beginning of the lecture next week, but I'm not going to focus too much on that since we've already talked about it. So last year, I told you something about what we call the meta functions of language, that language actually has many purposes, right? Many reasons, right, for doing language. And I guess the most obvious function of language is to represent reality, right? So this marker is black. It represents my understanding of this marker, my reality of this marker, which I think you share with me, right? So this is what we call the experiential function of language, or sometimes it's called the ideational function. function of language, right? So experiential, you think of the word experience, right? One function of language is to talk about our experience with the world, to describe, to explain our experience with the world, right? Ideational, you think of the word idea, right? So a function of language is to express our ideas, right? Express our ideas. But another function of language is to manage our relationships, right? So to help other people understand what their relationship is with us, right? Who has more power, who has less power, how close we are, how far we are, these sorts of things. And this is what we call the interpersonal relationship, the interpersonal metafunction of language. So the interpersonal metafunction of language has to do with my relationship with you, your relationship with me, but also my relationship with what I'm saying. Right? And your relationship with what I'm saying, right? How it affects you, that sort of thing. And then the last function of language is really to make connections between one piece of language and another piece of language. So, for example, to make a connection between one sentence in a text and the other sentence in the text so we know what their relationship is. Or to make the connection between one text and another text, right? So we know what their relationship is. And this is what we call the textual metafunction of language. So the first group of questions in those questions that I showed you all have to do with the experiential or the ideational metafunction of language, right? That is, who are the participants in your sentence and what are they doing? So what are the verbs? What are the objects? What are the subjects? Right? What participants are included or excluded and how are they named and what are they doing to each other? For example, I can have this sentence, John kissed Mary. In this sentence, we have two participants. They are John and Mary. We have a process which is kissed. What kind of process is it? It's a material process. It's a physical thing, right? He's physically kissing her. But we could have a very different sentence. Mary should have one R, not two. Mary kissed John, right? And so in this sentence, John kissed Mary, John is the one who is doing the action to Mary. Right? In the other sentence, Mary kissed John, Mary is the one who's doing the action to John. So it's a very, very different kind of sentence. Now, it's funny because when I experience John and Mary kissing, when I see John and Mary kissing, right? You know, when two people are kissing, it's actually quite difficult to tell, isn't it? Who's kissing whom? Isn't it? Right? It's really more like they're kissing each other, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, I walk into the classroom and I see John and Mary kissing in the classroom. I say, oh my God, right? John is kissing Mary. If I say that, what I'm saying is that my experience or my perception or my interpretation of this situation is that John is doing something to her. John is the guilty one. She is the innocent one. Right? She is the victim. Right? But if I say, Mary kissed John, then I mean that Mary is actually the one who takes responsibility for it. Right? So I can use either of these two sentences for the same situation, can't I? Because I don't really know who started the kissing, do I? Because I wasn't here when the kissing started. Right? And so the thing about the experiential metafunction is it is a way that we express reality, that we describe reality. But the most important thing about it is the way we interpret reality, right? Because the fact is, we don't really know who's kissing whom. We don't really know who started it, right? But by the sentence that we choose, we make some kind of interpretation of that. We make some kind of judgment of that. Or we may have a sentence, the army pacified the demonstrators, right? In this situation, we have two participants. We have the army and we have the demonstrators, right? And we have a process, pacify. Does anyone know what pacify means? Ever hear this word, pacify? Edward, you know pacify? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah. If you give somebody a sedative, they'll be pacified, right? Give somebody a sleeping pill, right? They'll be pacified, right? So pacify just means to make somebody peaceful, right? Make somebody peaceful. Make somebody calm, right? So to say that the army pacified the demonstrators, it sounds quite nice, doesn't it? You know, like they came and they gave all the demonstrators some sleeping pills or something. They all kind of fell asleep, something like that. So it sounds really nice. It sounds like, oh, this army is not so bad. It's pretty nice, yeah, right? But if you read the second sentence, you see more specifically how they pacified the demonstrators. The army shot the demonstrators. After they were shot, they were very peaceful, right? So you can see by the choice of words, by the way we choose to name our participants, and by the way we choose to name the processes, we give a different kind of feeling and really a different kind of interpretation to the sentence. The army pacified the demonstrators. Sounds like the army is quite good, right? The army shot the demonstrators. Sounds like the army is quite bad, right? So you can see this quite a lot in news reports as well, right? That the verbs and the nouns that they choose to describe what happened often give a kind of interpretation or a kind of color to it. The army shot the agitators. Here, the army doesn't seem so bad because agitators don't seem so good. Yeah, demonstrators seem okay, you know, like everyone should be able to go and demonstrate. It's no problem. But agitate sounds like, oh, it's not so good, you know, that they're troublemakers, right? And so in the last sentence, well, you feel, well, they shouldn't have shot them, but anyway, they were agitators anyway, so maybe it was really their fault. Right? So from these examples, you can see how when we engage in the experiential metafunction of language, when we engage in describing reality, we are always laying over reality our own interpretation of reality. In fact, it's impossible to be completely objective about reality. Whenever we describe reality, what we are really describing is our experience of reality, our interpretation of reality. And so here's the webpage from last year, Languages, Cultures, and Communication. Have a look at that reading. That's reading 3. And particularly, Edward, since you weren't here last year, right, have a look at that reading. And if you have any questions, you just let me know. Okay? Good. So today we're not going to speak so much. Oh, you guys as well. You guys as well. Are you taking Languages, Cultures, and Communications with Aditi this time? Okay, I don't know if Aditi is going to be talking so much about that. Has she talked anything about that so far? No? No? Okay. You think? You don't think so? Sometimes it's difficult to tell, right? Okay, no problem. You just have a look at that old reading from my old course. It's not a very long reading, and it will kind of sum up the important information for this. Right? So today what I'm really going to focus on is the interpersonal metafunction, right? And that has to do with the relationship, not only the relationship between the speaker or writer and the hearer or listener, but the relationship between the speaker or writer and the message, the meaning that I'm trying to convey. And the three main components of the interpersonal metafunction that I'm going to be focusing on today are the idea of foregrounding and backgrounding information, the idea of modality, and the idea of thematic development. And so foregrounding and backgrounding information. When we write or when we speak, what we say or write has a lot of information in it, right? Tons and tons and tons of information, right? And we have to decide as a listener or a reader which of this information is important. So as a speaker or a writer, we can help our readers and listeners understand which information is important by using grammar to push certain information to the front and then pull other information to the back. So pushing information to the front is called foregrounding it. That is emphasizing the information. Pulling it to the back is called backgrounding it. Right? That is putting it in a way that this particular information is treated as background information, right? Or information that's not so important, not so essential to the message. And there are basically two ways we do this with our grammar. One way is called linking, and the other way is called binding. Linking is when we put two clauses together in a way that conveys that the information in both of these clauses is of equal importance. So if I have two sentences, I ate my dog, it's one sentence, and the second sentence is I got sick. I ate my dog, I got sick. Two pieces of information. I want to put these two pieces of information together in a way that tells the reader that both of these two pieces of information are equal. And the way I do it, usually, is using a method called coordination. That is, I will use some kind of word to put these two sentences together. Does anyone know what kind of word I could use? Edward, I think you know.
I don't like to hear this word, but sequencing.
Secretly.
Consequently.
No. How about so? Yeah, okay. Yeah, how about so? You don't have to be so fancy. Consequently. So, how about so? Okay? So, we'll use so. Right? So, does anyone know what kind of word so is? Is it like a verb, an adjective, or? Good, it's a conjunction. It's a special kind of conjunction called a coordinating conjunction. Right? It's a kind of conjunction that we use to achieve coordination. So, Melody, what are the coordinating conjunctions in English? I know you know. List the coordinating conjunctions in English. List them. And, good. You got one. Yeah, any more? So is up there, right? So you got two. No, not since. Any suggestions? But, or, nor, for, but, you know, for meaning because, right? Okay? And, but, or, nor, for, so, and yet. And, but, or, nor, for, so, yet. Seven, okay? So every day when you wake up, look in the mirror and say, and, but, or, nor, for, so, yet. Okay. Next week I'm going to ask you what the coordinating conjunctions are in English, and Heidi, I'm sure you'll be able to recite them to me immediately. Yes? Okay. And, but, or, nor, for, so, yet. But the important thing about these coordinating conjunctions is not only do they join these two sentences together, but they show what the relationship between these two sentences is. Right? So if I use and, that creates what we call an additive relationship. I add one thing to another thing. Right? I ate my dog and I got sick. All that tells you is that these two things happened. Right? It doesn't tell you if this happened because this happened or this happened because this happened. Right? It just tells you these two things happened. Right? But if I use, as Edward suggests, if I use so, this shows a causative relationship. Right? So me getting sick is the result of I ate my dog. So, cause, result. I ate my dog, so I got sick. But, a contradictory relationship, right? I ate my dog, but I got sick. It's a different, totally different story, isn't it? Right? The first one, Edwards, is that I got sick because I ate my dog. The second one is, I didn't expect to get sick, but I did get sick. Right? I ate my dog, but in fact, the purpose of eating my dog was so I wouldn't get sick. Right? Because it's winter time, getting colder outside, somebody told me I should eat dog meat, makes me strong, I can avoid catching a cold. So I immediately went home, ate my dog. Right? But unfortunately, unexpectedly, I still got sick. Right? I ate my dog, but I got sick. I ate my dog, yet I got sick. I don't think you could say I ate my dog or I got sick. It doesn't really make so much sense. Okay? So, first point is we use these conjunctions to join the sentences together. Second point is they show the relationship between the sentences. The third point, most important point, is that when I do it this way, it's like scales. Yeah? That both of these pieces of information are seen as equally important. Right? Both of them are equally emphasized in the sentence. Okay? There's not one piece of information that's more important than the other. The fact that I ate my dog is not more important than the fact that I got sick. The fact that I got sick is not more important than the fact that I ate my dog. They are equal. So I could join them together with one of these conjunctions, but I could also use one of these. You know what that is? It's a semicolon, one of my favorite marks. Very cute, don't you think? Semicolon? Yeah. I could use a semicolon to put them together as well. All right. So here are some examples up here. Put up or shut up, okay? The economy has transformed, but the infrastructure of the new towns has not been improved. So the information that the economy has transformed and the information that the infrastructure of the new towns has not been improved are seen as equal. Don't worry about it. Grandma doesn't know what she means. The fact that you shouldn't worry about it and the fact that grandma doesn't know what she means, both of these pieces of information are seen as relatively equal. The intention of the plan was to benefit the people of this district, but this has not been achieved. Okay? The fact that the intention of the plan was to benefit the people of the district and the fact that this has not been achieved are portrayed as having equal status in this kind of sentence. Okay? And so when you have two ideas and you think that one idea is not more important than the other idea, that they're both fairly equal, this is the kind of method that you would use. Yeah? If, on the other hand, you think that one of the ideas is more important than the other idea, then you might want to combine your sentences in a slightly different way. You might want to use the method of binding. And binding has several different kinds of methods that you can use to do it. And the first is called subordination. Although I ate my dog, I got sick. Although I ate my dog, I got sick. In this sentence, what is the main clause? What is the main clause of this sentence? I got sick. Right? So, since it is the main clause, this is the most important piece of information in the sentence. This is what we call a subordinate clause. Subordinate means low, doesn't it? Right? If somebody's your subordinate, it means that you're higher than them. Right? So a subordinate clause is lower than a main clause. So even though this clause is longer than this clause, actually, this clause stands out more as the main clause. This clause goes into the background. And so in the sentence, although I ate my dog, I got sick, the fact that I got sick is emphasized more than the fact that I ate my dog. The fact that I ate my dog is slightly backgrounded. It's still there, it's still quite strong, but slightly backgrounded because it was put in this kind of subordinate clause. I could also put it in a different kind of clause, right? I could put it in a relative clause. So, for example, my dog, which I ate, made me sick. Okay? So a relative clause is one of these clauses that starts with like which, who, whom, those kinds of clauses. Right? If I do this, then the fact that I ate my dog becomes even more backgrounded. Right? It goes further and further in the background. And the fact that I got sick or my dog made me sick, right, becomes the important information. In fact, the fact that I ate the dog is surrounded by commas here. I could even take it off, couldn't I? Right? My dog made me sick. Right? Totally lost the whole idea that I ate the dog. Right? And so putting something in a relative clause is also a way to background it a little bit. So we can see these two sentences here. Right? And remember the original sentence, the coordinated sentence? Although the intention of the plan was to benefit the people of the district, this has not been achieved. So this is actually a slightly more negative sentence than the first one, because the idea of the intention to benefit people is slightly backgrounded, right? And the idea of not achieving it is foregrounded more. And this is even more negative. The plan, which was originally intended to benefit the people of the district, has failed utterly to achieve its goal. And so by putting the idea that the plan was intended to benefit the people of the district in a relative clause, that backgrounds it even more. Right? And so in this way we give our text a certain kind of texture, right? We help to express, pay attention to this. Don't pay attention to this bit so much. Pay more attention to this bit. This is basically how writers do that. Another way to do it is to take the information and put it in a prepositional phrase. For example, after eating my dog, I got sick. And so again, the idea of eating my dog by being put in this prepositional phrase is backgrounded a little bit, right? And the fact that I got sick is foregrounded a little bit. In fact, we could background it even more by saying something like, I got sick on dog. Yeah? I got sick on dog. Right? So for example, if you drink a lot of beer, you can say, I got sick on beer. Yeah? Here, you ate a lot of dog, you can say, I got sick on dog. But the thing is, by putting that in this prepositional phrase, the whole idea that you ate the dog has practically disappeared, hasn't it? Right? It's been so backgrounded, right, that it's practically disappeared. In fact, unless you know something about the context of the situation, you may not even realize that what actually occurred was that I ate my dog. So you can see here, despite its original intention to benefit the people of this district, the plan has not achieved this. Okay? So again, the intention to benefit is being backgrounded, and the failure of the plan is being foregrounded. We could also use a participial phrase. For example, having eaten my dog, I got sick. Again, I got sick is foregrounded here, and the fact of me eating my dog is being backgrounded. Or as here, originally well-intentioned, the government failed to follow through this plan. So you can see how each of these sentences up here is becoming progressively more negative feeling, right? Because the whole idea of trying to help people is being backgrounded, and the idea of failing to help people is being foregrounded. The last one is probably the most important, yeah? And that's what we call nominalization. Nominalization. And nominalization is where you take the whole clause and you make it into a noun. Right? You take the whole clause and you make it into one word. Right? For example, unemployment. Unemployment is actually a nominalization of something that happened. Something actually happened. What happened? Somebody lost their job. Or somebody fired somebody. Right? Somebody fired somebody. Right? But when we say unemployment, the whole story of somebody being fired and losing their job is sort of packed into this one word. Right? Kind of hidden in this one word. Right? So if I say, oh, you know, people in Hong Kong are kind of sad now, because a lot of people are firing other people. Then you think, oh, they're really bad. That's really terrible. They're fired. But if I say, oh, you know, a lot of people in Hong Kong are not so happy now because of high unemployment, then you think, oh, yeah, high unemployment is sort of like the weather. You know, it's like sunny or rainy. You don't blame anybody, right? And so that's one of the key uses of nominalization, to hide who the participants and who the processes are into this kind of a nominalization. So here's an example. Good intentions cannot make up for the failure of this plan. Or we can say, dog eating made me sick. Right? Dog eating made me sick. So, I have a little task for you to do. And I don't know if you downloaded this or not, but I'll project it onto the screen. This is a little story. This is a little story about my friend Kevin. Kevin just found a new girlfriend. Yeah? And as is typical of a boy with their new girlfriend, they like to invite the girlfriend to go out on a date. And of course, the best place to go on a date with your new girlfriend is the cinema. Why is that the case? Because the cinema is dark. Yes? And so maybe he will have a chance to kiss the girl. Yeah? So this is a story about a boy trying to kiss a girl in a cinema. But the story is written in a rather strange way. And when I read the story to you, you'll probably feel, you'll experience that it's written in kind of a strange way. Because the way the story is written, every clause only has one piece of information. Every sentence only has one piece of information. And every piece of information in the story is given one sentence, is given one clause. Right? And so it is written in a way so that every single piece of information in the story is treated as equal. Right? And when I read it to you, I'm sure you'll experience the kind of effect that this has. So let me read it to you. Readiness is all, it's called. Kevin felt tense. He felt unsure of himself. He edged closer to his date. He sneaked a sideways look. The movie theater was dark. Her profile was still visible. Her profile was backlighted. He stared at her mouth. Her mouth was full. Her mouth was inviting. He swallowed his fear. Music began to swell. The movie's intrigue heightened. He could hear his own breathing. His breathing was labored. He told himself something. It's now or never. There was a pause. The pause was long. The pause was breathless. Nothing happened. And then she tilted her head. The tilt was ever so slight. The tilt was in his direction. She lifted her chin. She leaned back against his arm. She closed her eyes. Now, although the content of the story is quite romantic, quite exciting, the style in which the story is written, how do you feel about it? It's good? It seems a bit boring, isn't it? A bit flat, a bit monotonous, and even a little difficult to understand. Right? And the reason for this is that every sentence has only one piece of information, and every piece of information in the story has one sentence. Right? So the reader of this story doesn't know what information is important and what information isn't important. Right? What information should be foregrounded and what information should be backgrounded. And so we're going to rewrite this story together, right, in a way that foregrounds what we think is the important information and backgrounds what we think is maybe not such important information. So let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, that's okay. Let's have you guys here. Yeah? I want you to do the first sentence. Yeah? And you guys, I want you to do the second sentence, okay? And you guys, all the way up to Margaret, yeah? I want you to do the third sentence, yeah? And then up to Lillian, I want you to do the fourth group of sentences, because that's very short, right? So you only have a small group, right? And then you guys do the fifth, and you guys do the sixth, and I'll do the seventh. How's that? Okay? So I'll give you about 10 minutes, all right, to talk to your classmates. What I want you to do is look at your group of sentences. I want you to combine all of that information into one sentence. Okay? All of the information into one sentence. So the trick is to try to figure out what is the interesting or the important information in the group of sentences and try to foreground it. Right? The second trick is to find out what's not so important and try to background it. So take about 10 minutes to discuss that with your classmates. Okay, let's continue. So, back to the interpersonal metafunction of language. The second topic within the interpersonal metafunction of language is the idea of modality. So modality has to do with how certain we are about what we're saying. It has to do with our idea about how true what we're saying is, right? It has the idea of how much authority with which we are saying something. And so we express modality in English using words like may, might, could, will, must, it seems to me, without a doubt, it's possible, etc., etc. And so, for example, I can have a sentence like Kenji kissed my dog. Okay? Sorry. Now, if I say the sentence this way, did it happen? Did it happen? Yes, it happened. It happened, right? I'm not creating any doubt about this happening. I'm stating it as a fact, right? It happened, right? But I might not be so sure. So I might say something like, Kenji might have kissed my dog. I'm not sure, but I see some dog hair on his face. And so I guess, well, he might have or he may have kissed my dog, right? Or I may want to express something about my feelings about whether or not this should happen. For example, Kenji should have kissed my dog, right? Or I might do it in some other ways. For example, I might say something like, without a doubt, Kenji kissed my dog. Or I might say something like, Kenji probably kissed my dog. Or Kenji possibly kissed my dog. Things like this. So all of these are ways that we show modality in English. In fact, these words, may, might, could, will, and must, what are these kinds of words called? They're called modal verbs, right? Modal verbs because they're used in English to express modality, right? To express the truth value of what we're saying, right? How true or false it is. And this is extremely important in discourse analysis because here we can try to understand how true somebody is trying to make us think something is. Let me give you an example. And so in America, the government hired some scientists to write a report about global warming. You all understand global warming, yes? Yes? Okay. So global warming is too much carbon dioxide in the air, right? Magnifies the sun's rays, causing the earth to get hotter and hotter and hotter. Now, this is a kind of a problem. You might say, well, no problem. I like hot weather. I can get a suntan. Right? But this can cause some problems, right? One of the main problems is that as the Earth gets hotter and hotter and hotter, then the ice on the North Pole and the ice on the South Pole melts, right? And when the ice melts, there's more water in the ocean. And so the level of the ocean rises. And so places that are very close to sea level, like Hong Kong, for example, are likely to be underwater, right, unless we stop global warming, right? So this is the thing about global warming. So this is what the scientists say about global warming. Warming will also cause reductions in mountain glaciers and advance the timing of the melt of mountain snowpacks in polar regions. In turn, runoff weights will change and the flood potential will be altered in ways that are currently not well understood. There will be significant shifts in the seasonality of runoffs that will have serious impacts on native populations that rely on fishing and hunting for their livelihood. These changes will be further complicated by shifts in precipitation regimes and possible intensification and increased frequency of extreme hydrologic events. So in this account of global warming, this is all about something that's going to happen in the future. Do these scientists think that this is going to happen? Yes or no? Do they think that it's definitely going to happen? Yes. They don't think it's probably going to happen. They don't think it might happen. They don't think it's possible that it could happen. They think it's definitely going to happen. How do you know? Will. Right? So will is a very strong modal verb, right? Will is, I mean, if I say, you know, you've got to do your assignment and you've got to turn it in on time, and you say, yes, I will do it. You don't say, oh, I might, I might do it. Right? You say, you will do it, right? So it's a kind of a commitment to a certain kind of order of truth, a certain kind of reality. So these scientists clearly from this text believe that this actually will happen. So the government asked the scientists to write the report, right? And then the government, the office of the president, yeah, they read the report and they didn't like the report so much. Right? And so they decided to make some small revisions in the report. Right? They say, don't worry, we won't change the content of the report. We'll just change the grammar a little bit, fix up the grammar for you a little bit. Right? And so this is the result. Warming would also cause reductions in mountain glaciers and advance the timing of melt on mountain snowpacks in polar regions. In turn, runoff rates would change and flood potential would be altered in ways that are currently not well understood. In this version of the text, is this definitely going to happen? Not necessarily. Might happen. How do you know? Would. So changing the modal verb will to the modal verb would creates what we call a conditional. Right? So this will happen only under certain conditions. Right? But in this text, we don't even know what the conditions are. Right? So it gives you the feeling that whether this is going to happen or not is a little bit unsure. Right? And in fact, after that, they further revise the text to warming could also lead to changes in the water cycle in polar regions. In fact, the whole text was reduced to this one sentence. So all of those horrible things that were going to happen, they're hidden. They're hidden in the nominalization changes in the water cycle in polar regions, right? To represent all of those things that were going to happen. And so the government, well, maybe the American government doesn't want people to be too worried about global warming. And so by changing the text like this, instead of making global warming into something that's definitely going to happen, it makes global warming seem like, oh yeah, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen. Who knows? Anyway, right? And this is obviously in order to promote their own interests, because maybe the government doesn't want people to think about global warming so much. Maybe they don't want people to be worried so much about global warming. And so you can see, just by changing a few words, just by changing the modality of the text from high modality to low modality, it changes our whole view of global warming. It changes our whole view of reality. And this kind of thing can be used for political purposes or for the purpose of manipulating people's ideas about certain kinds of things. So we can do modality in a whole bunch of different ways, right? We can use modal verbs, but we could also use adverbs like probably, possibly, certainly, perhaps, maybe, or adverbs of time like sometimes, often, always, never, seldom, rarely, usually, or talking about how readily people do things like willingly, readily, gladly, certainly, easily, right? Or obligation, definitely, absolutely, possibly, at all costs and by all means. So I'll let you look through this chart yourself. This is just a whole chart showing all the different ways that we can show modality, and also here by prefacing our remarks with things like frankly, or to tell the truth, or honestly, or evidently, or apparently, or presumably, right? So many different ways in English we can use. So when you're analyzing your text, these are the kinds of words that you need to watch out for, right? And as soon as you see these words, you say, okay, why are they doing this, right? Why are they trying to lower my expectations about the reality of their statement, right? And there are lots of different reasons. Sometimes they actually don't want you to believe the statement is true. Sometimes they don't want to commit themselves to the statement. So very often when you read academic papers, right, people don't want to commit themselves to the statement just in case somebody proves them wrong, right? And so they use a lot of modality. This is what we call hedging. 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 You know what a hedge is? A hedge is like plants. Yeah? It's a row of plants. Right? That's set. So in America, people have gardens, right? And between the two gardens, they'll put a hedge, right? So the hedge between my garden and your garden, it's a row of plants, right? But in language, what hedging does is it separates me from what I say, right? And so I don't have to commit myself to what I say. So if I say, I'll be there tomorrow, no hedging. But if I say, oh, yeah, I'll probably be there tomorrow, there's some hedging. Or I could hedge even more. Oh, I might, possibly, probably, could be, maybe, be there tomorrow. Yeah, right? Something like that. So the more hedging, the more I'm kind of backing away from what I'm saying. I'd say, oh, I'm not really so sure of this. Okay, so that's modality. The last topic for today is what we call thematic development. Thematic development has to do with the way you arrange sentences in a text to give it a kind of structure, but also to highlight what is the topic that you're talking about, what is the theme of your text. So I'd like you to look at these three sentences. The first sentence, the victorious footballers stepped off the plane. Yeah? The victorious footballers stepped off the plane. Now, which sentence sounds better as the second sentence? Listen. The victorious footballers stepped off the plane. Cheering fans immediately swamped them. That's the first choice. Second choice. The victorious footballers stepped off the plane. They were immediately swamped by cheering fans. That's the second sentence. Listen again. First choice. The victorious footballers stepped off the plane. Cheering fans immediately swamped them. Second sentence. The victorious footballers stepped off the plane. They were immediately swamped by cheering fans. How many people like the first choice? How many people like the second choice? Okay, it seems more people like the second choice. Both choices are possible, but it seems more people like the second choice. Why? Why? Lillian, you said you like the second choice. Why? Just sounds better or feels better. It's just a kind of feeling, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah. I know. I mean, most people like the second choice better, right? But most people don't know why they like the second choice better. It's just a kind of feeling. But there is a reason why the second choice sounds better to you. And that reason is that this sentence begins with the footballers. This sentence begins with the fans. You already know about the footballers, but you don't know about the fans. So if you use the first choice here, the victorious footballers stepped off the plane, cheering fans immediately swamped them, you feel a little uncomfortable. Because you say, fans? What fans? Where did the fans come from? Right? Because this sentence begins with new information, right, that you're not prepared for. This sentence begins with the old information, and it puts the new information at the end of the sentence. So you already know about the footballers. So when you hear they, you feel very comfortable. Like, oh yeah, the footballers, and then you find out about the fans. Right? And so thematic development is all about how we arrange new and old information in our passage. Right? How we show which information is new information and which information is old information. And so every sentence is divided in, every clause really, is divided into two parts. We call these two parts the theme and the ream. The theme and the ream. The theme is the beginning of the sentence. The victorious footballers is the theme. They is the theme. Okay? So the theme is the beginning of the sentence. It's the kind of starting point of the sentence. Right? And then the rest of the sentence is what's called the ream. Right? So stepped off the plane. We're immediately swamped by cheering fans. This is the ream of the sentence. So the ream of the sentence is the rest of the sentence. It's really the kind of what you're saying about the theme. So we can say that the theme, Kenji, right, and the ream, kiss my dog, have a relationship like a topic and a comment. Kenji is the topic of my sentence. Right? He's the subject of the sentence. Right? He's what I'm talking about. He's who I'm talking about. Kiss my dog is what I'm saying about Kenji. It's the comment on the topic of the sentence. Right? So usually this is considered what we call old information or given information. And this is considered new information. So you know Kenji already. As soon as I say Kenji, you go, oh yeah, Kenji, I know Kenji. Yeah, yeah, my classmate Kenji. Right? But you don't know he kissed my dog. Right? That's the new information. That's the gossip, right, that you don't know. Right? And that generally goes at the end of the sentence. Generally goes in the ream. Let me show you another example just to clarify. So the subjects in our study were all healthy adult males. Okay? This is a sentence from a research article. Yeah? The theme of the sentence is the subjects of our study. The ream of the sentence is we're all healthy adult males. Okay? The theme of the sentence is the old information. You know that my study had subjects. Right? You're already reading my research article. I did a study. Obviously, I had subjects. Right? So you already know about the subjects, but you don't know who they are. Right? So the new information tells you who the subjects are. Right? So the theme is the jumping off idea. Right? Often it's linked to some kind of previous clause or sentence, and the ream is kind of the new information. Maybe not necessarily new, but we can think of it as newsworthy, right? Something that's kind of noticeable, right? Something that you want to comment upon. Something that is actually the more important information in a sentence. Right? One of the interesting things about the way we read English, and I'm not so sure if this is true about the way you read Chinese or not, but usually in a sentence, we put the more important information or the new information or the information we want to emphasize closer to the end of the sentence. Right? We put the old information closer to the beginning of the sentence. And that's true for passages as well, isn't it? Right? That we put the more interesting part of our paragraph at the end of the paragraph. We put our more interesting part of the story at the end of the story. Right? Because that's the kind of punchline, isn't it? That's the thing that people tend to pay more attention to. And so we use this to organize the old and new information, but also to organize our text in general. And so look at this passage. The brain is our most precious organ. What's the theme? The brain. It is the one above all which allows us to be human. What's the theme? it. Yeah? The brain contains 10 million nerve cells making thousands of billions connections with each other. What's the theme? The brain. Good. It is the most powerful data processor we know, but at the same time, it is incredibly delicate. What's the theme? It. As soft as a ripe avocado, the brain has to be encased in the tough bones of the skull and floats in its own waterbed of fluid. What's the theme? Well, actually, the theme is as soft as a ripe avocado, the brain. Okay? So everything at the beginning of the sentence is the theme, right? And floats in its own waterbed. An adult brain weighs over 3 pounds and fills the skull. What's the theme? So what do you notice about this passage? The theme is always the same, right? The theme is repeated over and over again. And that's one reason why this passage seems organized to us, right? This is one way that a writer can use in order to organize their passage, right? Simply to use the same theme over and over again. Right? Of course, you don't want to say the same word over and over again. You don't want to say the brain, the brain, the brain, the brain, the brain. That's kind of boring. So you replace it with a pronoun. You say it. Right? The brain, blah, 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 it, blah, 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 it, blah, 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 the brain, blah, 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 it, blah, blah, blah. Right? But you get this feeling that it gives the text a feeling that it's organized. And also you will notice that the brain is always the old information. The theme is always the old information because I already know we're talking about the brain. Right? So I don't have to pay so much attention to the beginning of the sentence. I know we're talking about the brain. Right? I go right to the new information, which is the brain, how much it weighs, right? That it floats in the water, and whatever else the brain does. Here's another example. Right? This is from a research article about advertisements in the MTR. Right? So this writer is writing about advertisements in the MTR. And he starts his theme, most readers of this ad. And the second sentence, he starts with most, which is the same as most readers in this ad. The third is those with some knowledge of traditional Chinese symbols, which is also most readers of this ad. Local Cantonese speakers, which is also most readers of this ad, and older Chinese residents of Hong Kong, which are some readers of this ad. So every single sentence begins with some kind of representation of the people who are reading this ad. So again, he keeps repeating the theme over and over again. So that is one very kind of typical way to organize information in a passage. Simply by repeating the theme, using the same theme over and over again. But that's not the only way to do it. There are other ways to do it as well. So, for example, here, once upon a time, a very long time ago, now, about last Friday, Winnie the Pooh lived in a forest, all by himself, under the name of Sanders. One day, when he was walking, he came to an open place in the middle of the forest. And in the middle of this place was a very large oak tree. And from the top of the tree, there came a long buzzing noise. So the thematic organization of this passage is a little bit different. It looks a bit more like this. Right? So the rheim here, Winnie the Pooh living in the forest, is repeated in the theme, he was out walking, right? And then the rheim here, he came upon an open place in the middle of the forest, is repeated in the theme of the next clause, in the middle of this place. And the rheim, the very large oak tree, is repeated in the theme of the next clause, on top of the tree, right? And so here we have a kind of passage that goes theme, rheim, but then the rheim becomes the theme of the next clause, and the rheim becomes the theme of the next clause, and the rheim becomes the theme of the next clause, which is another very, very typical way to organize a passage. So this is the second pattern, and This is the first pattern, right? Repeating the themes over and over again. Second pattern is making the ring the next theme, making this ring the next theme, making this ring the next theme. Here's another example. Many Hong Kong students enjoy using ICQ. Okay? ICQ is the ring, or inside of the ring. Okay? Then ICQ becomes the theme of the next sentence. ICQ is an internet chat program. And then internet chat program becomes the theme of the next sentence. Internet chat is changing the way people communicate. Right? Okay? So it's very, very simple, these two kind of basic patterns of thematic organization. But we don't always do it that way. Yeah? We don't always simply start our theme with a subject or a noun. Right? Sometimes we change our themes around a little bit, and this is what we call marked themes. So you should already know what the word marked means. What does the word marked mean? Marked. Marked means unusual. Yeah? Unusual. Not the usual way to do it. Right? Unconventional in some way. Right? So in English, the usual way to do it, the unmarked, way to do it is to use the subject of the sentence as the theme, isn't it? So, Kenji kissed my dog. Yeah? What's the subject of the sentence? Kenji. What's the theme of the sentence? Kenji. So this is normal, right? This is unmarked. This is unremarkable. You see this? Oh, it's a normal sentence, right? But I could change it. I could say, my dog, Kenji, kissed. What's the subject of the sentence? Still Kenji. Yeah? Still Kenji. Right? What's the theme of the sentence? My dog. Right? So the theme is always the first part of the sentence, no matter whether it's a subject or not. So if I change the sentence around, if I put the subject somewhere else in the sentence, I change the thematic organization. And so I create an unusual sentence. It's not a wrong sentence, but it's an unusual sentence. And I've created this unusual sentence in order to create some kind of special meaning, to emphasize something, or to create some kind of special meaning. And so, for example, John kissed Mary, right? In this case, the subject and the theme are the same. That's normal. But in the second one, Mary was kissed by John, I changed the verb to the passive voice. Right? So actually the subject of the verb is still John, yeah? But then Mary becomes the theme. So maybe I'm emphasizing Mary more. It was John who kissed Mary. Right? So here, it was John becomes the theme. Not just John, but it was John. It was Mary who was kissed by John. Right? Here, it was Mary becomes the theme. What John did was kiss Mary. What John did becomes the theme of the sentence. Not just John, but what John did. Right? Who John kissed was Mary. Right? Here, who John kissed becomes the theme. And Mary, John kissed her. Right? Here, Mary becomes the theme again. So why would we do this? Why would we change the theme around? Well, in English, there are some special reasons for it, some special purposes for it. It creates a certain kind of effect. Right? So the first kind of effect is what we call a thematized object or complement. Do you understand what an object and complement is? Right? I ate my dog. Subject, object. Okay? I am a dog. Subject, subject complement. Understand? Okay? So a thematized object or complement is when you take the object or the complement and make it a theme. Right? My dog I ate, or a dog I am. Or as in these sentences, I really like Sebastian, but his sister I cannot stand. Okay? His sister is the theme. I cannot stand is the ring. But I am actually the subject of this clause. Right? I cannot stand his sister. But instead of saying, I cannot stand his sister, I say, his sister I cannot stand. I really like Sebastian, but his sister I cannot stand. Most of the examples are authentic, but this example I invented. Rather than saying, I invented this example I invented. A Fei Wong fan I am, and a Fei Wong fan I will always be. Right? Rather than saying, I am a Fei Wong fan, I say, a Fei Wong fan I am. Why do we do this? Why do we do this? Well, usually in English we do it to create some kind of contrast, right, with what we said previously, right? So, for example, I like Sebastian, right? In contrast to the fact that I like Sebastian, I don't like his sister, right? So I use this thematized object. I like Sebastian, but his sister I cannot stand. Right? Edward likes Leon Lai. I like Fei Wong. Right? A Fei Wong fan I am. A Fei Wong fan I will always be. You like Fei Wong? Wong Fei? Yeah, of course. You must. You must. She's the queen of Cantopop. You don't know? Yeah, she is. Okay, so you can see we don't just do this randomly. Right? And this is actually quite important for your writing as well, right? That you don't just do this randomly. You do it for some kind of communicative effect. You do it for some kind of purpose. And so when people use this kind of device of making the object the theme or making the complement the theme, they're usually trying to create a sense of contrast, create a sense of comparison in some way, right? Or thematized circumstantial adjunct. Don't worry about these words, circumstantial adjunct. It's a very fancy word. I guess you took English grammar? Yeah, with what, Alice or Viking? Did you take English grammar? Yeah, wonderful course, huh? Yeah? You remember what a circumstantial adjunct is? Forgot it all. Good on you. Yeah, don't worry, it's grammar. It's ridiculous, right? You don't have to worry about the terms. Really, the terms are not important. But just remember that an adjunct just is something that's joined on to a sentence, right? You join it on, right? A circumstantial adjunct is something that you join onto a sentence that tells something about the circumstances or the conditions or the situation in which the sentence occurs, right? So things like later that evening or after considering the intensity of her smile, things like this. So sometimes I don't actually start with the subject Jenny. Sometimes I put something before that, right? Or here, Aristo, I don't start with that. I put something before that, right? And there are lots of reasons to do that, right? Usually the main reason to do this is to help me to organize the text, right? So often it's circumstantial adjuncts of time to show what happened first, what happened after that, what happened later, what happened finally, that sort of thing. And so this is the kind of thing your secondary school teacher taught you how to do when you were writing your essays, right? Firstly, secondly, thirdly, finally, in conclusion, right? That sort of thing. Those are adjuncts, right? So usually we use it as a kind of way to develop our text, right? Absolute themes, right? Absolute themes. This is the as for this, blah 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 blah. As for that, blah 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 blah. It's very very popular in writing from students, from Chinese students, to do this. All right, to start something like as for blah blah blah, or for my study, I would like to blah blah blah. Right? That sort of thing. It's actually very very common in Chinese. It's not so marked in Chinese. It's more normal in Chinese. In English, it's very marked. Right? So that in English, when you do this, it's not wrong. It's still right. It's still correct to do it, but you have a kind of effect, a kind of communicative effect. And the most important effect is highlighting, really strongly highlighting what you have in your theme. All right? And also often to show a transition. Right? So for example, I'm talking about different assignments. Right? So I say, okay, you have several assignments in this course. One assignment is your field investigations. And in your field investigation, really what I'm mostly concerned about is that, you know, you show me some kind of analytical skill, right? As for the second assignment, which is your article critique, I'm much more interested in good grammar in that assignment, right? So you can see as for connects it to the last thing and also creates this kind of contrast, doesn't it, right? So for this assignment, blah, 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 blah. As for the second assignment, blah, 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 okay? Or in writing, we have to strive to be as concrete, as specific as possible. When we speak, we don't really have to worry too much about what we say. We can just, you know, speak very, very casually. But in writing, we have to strive to be as concrete and specific as possible. Right? So you can see by taking this and putting it in the center, you create this kind of effect. You create this kind of contrast. But do note this. It's very important for your English writing that most people I know, most Hong Kong students I know, use this much too much. Yeah, they use it all the time, right? Because I think in Chinese it's quite common to say things this way, to have an absolute theme. In English, we only do it when we're trying to create this kind of emphasis or trying to create this kind of contrast. Right? Interpersonal themes. Sometimes we'll begin our sentence by telling something about what we think about what we're going to say. For example, actually, presumably, undoubtedly, in my view, in my opinion, all these sorts of things. And this, basically, what it does is a kind of modality, isn't it, right? It kind of gives you a feeling about the truth value. So if I say, Kenji loves dogs, right? That gives you that's true, that's a fact, yeah? But if I say, in my opinion, Kenji loves dogs, right? Then you think, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. It's just your opinion, isn't it? Right? So this actually tends to soften things a little bit. Textual themes. Right? So a textual theme is basically using some kind of connective word. So again, what your secondary school teacher taught you about how to write your essays. In view of the above reasons, blah, 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 or therefore, blah, 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 or however, blah, 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 or moreover, blah, 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 or nevertheless, blah, 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 right? And these are very easily just basically to show the relationship between one sentence and another. And then finally we get to the passive voice. Passive voice is really funny. People don't really realize why we use the passive voice. And there are a lot of reasons why we use the passive voice. But one of the main reasons we use the passive voice is in order to create a feeling about what's new information and what's given information. The Statue of David was finished in 1504, right? Who finished the Statue of David in 1504? You know the Statue of David? You know the Statue of David? You don't know the Statue of David? It's a very famous statue. Yeah, very famous statue. Who carved the Statue of David? Michelangelo. Yeah? Michelangelo. Right? I saw the Statue of David in Florence. How tall do you think it is? About this tall? About this tall? About this tall? It's huge. It's huge. It's like, wow. I never realized. I always thought like the Statue of David's like this. It looks kind of small in the picture, you know, but it's huge. It's really big, right? So the Statue of David was finished in 1504 by Michelangelo, right? So why don't I say Michelangelo finished the Statue of David in 1504? Well, maybe a couple of reasons. One reason may be I don't want to tell you who did it. Yeah. Sometimes when we use a passive voice, we don't want to tell you who did it.
right? We want to de-emphasize the agent, right? And we just want to talk about the results, right? But really the main reason we use the passive voice is to make the statue of David into the old information and to make when it was finished into the new information, right? So maybe in my text I'm talking about the statue of David. The statue of David was, you know, a very, very famous statue. It was, you know, it's in the Uffizi Museum in Florence. Many people go and see the statue of David every day. The statue of David, so I want the statue of David to be in the beginning of the sentence for the organization of my text, right? So that's one reason. It is hoped that all the students will take the opportunity to practice their Putonghua with Jackie, right? Again, I think here it's more just to leave out who's doing the hoping, right? Is make it seem like, you know, everybody should hope this somehow, right? Such courses are normally provided by universities, rather than say universities normally provide such courses. It could be in this case that basically I want to thematize the courses. I want to make the courses the old information, and I want the universities to be new information. For example, many people are interested in taking courses in Chinese painting. Such courses are normally provided by universities. So emphasizing that universities is the new information. So keep in mind that whatever I'm putting at the end of the sentence tends to be emphasized a little more. So one of the main reasons we use the passive voice is so that we can emphasize the subject. It's a kind of a contradiction. There are two reasons to use the passive voice. One reason is so we can leave out the subject. Another reason is so that we can emphasize the subject. Right? So, my dog was kissed by Kenji. Yeah? It actually emphasizes Kenji even more, doesn't it? If I say, oh, Kenji kissed my dog. But if I say, my dog was kissed by him. Yeah? It really implicates him much more. Okay. We're going to finish these next week, right? Because we still have a few more to go. And the other class is also a little bit behind on this. So we'll talk about clefting and existential clauses next week, and we'll finish this up and we'll do the task. Yeah?